Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. A large Dayton health network was recently hit with a cyber attack that compromised close to 730,000 files. This isn't the first time Ohio has faced an attack like this, and it may not be the last, especially if preventative measures are not taken. Joining us now is Sean Waldman, founder and CEO of Secure Cyber, a company that helps businesses and governments protect themselves against cyber attacks. Welcome to All Sides, Sean.
Thanks, Amy.
So in 2023, your company began what's called the Go Cyber Collective, a branch of your company that is a nonprofit effort for cyber awareness training. Can you tell me a little bit about how you try to help businesses and governments have what happened to Kettering Health not happen?
Yeah, so I started that nonprofit 2 years ago. And the reason I started it was because I saw that the community was very siloed in cyber, meaning that people were keeping attacks to themselves. They felt very isolated. They felt like the cybersecurity problems that were out there were things that they had to tackle all by themselves. And the whole basis of the nonprofit was to take down those walls, get the community together, and really create a pool of resources as education, networking, so that when an event like Kettering Health was to occur, that the region would have a pool of resources available that would be able to either come in and help, offer just opportunities to talk about the incident and, you know, discuss countermeasures to keeping yourself secure. It was really just to be a beacon of light from a cyber perspective for the region and eventually, hopefully, for the state.
Now, you were not involved in helping Kettering Health, or Kettering Health had not hired you. You just know about it. So can you tell me a little bit about, do you know what happened at Kettering Health as to how they were able, how more than 700,000 files were compromised? Is there any clear indication of what happened?
No, there's no clear indication of what happened. What we do know is that the threat actor that was involved was an organization called Interlock. It was an organization that doesn't appear to be directly attributed to either a nation or a state sponsor specifically. A lot of what I know about Interlock and what is published of Interlock has what I would call North Korean pointers to it, if we had to try and attribute it to somebody like that. But Interlock is a ransomware as a service organization. It's organized crime. And they were considered a big game hunter. So Kettering Health was very specifically targeted. This was not a necessarily an opportunistic attack like we sometimes see. So this organization was specifically targeted for their industry, and they were attacked purposely.
Is there a reason for a health company to be attacked? Is it because they have so much information? They have personal information. They have health information. They have financial information because you have to pay for the healthcare. Is that why they were more vulnerable, because they have so much?
Yeah, protected health information from a value perspective for a threat actor, there's a high amount of value. These threat actors operate generally on a situation where they're doing what's called double extortion. So the first level of extortion is to get their malware into the organization, perform the encryption, and then demand a ransom in order for the data to be recovered. Stage two of that, the double part of the extortion, is that if, like in this case, Kettering Health does not pay and they're able to get back up and running all by themselves, the second part of the extortion comes in when the threat actor posts the information, like we saw, to the dark web, similar to what happened with the city of Columbus. And then they demand a ransom to take that information down.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about ransom. So obviously the hackers want ransom. That's kind of a part of the point of all of this. It's either that or they sell the information or put it on the dark web. So do places sometimes pay the ransom, or is the normal standard process to not pay it and try to recover it yourself?
Well, the answer is a lot of organizations do pay it, unfortunately, and that ends up fueling the fire, so to speak. So if you continue to, well, it's like setting milk out for a stray cat, right? The cat's going to keep coming back for the milk. So if you keep paying the money, the threat actors are fueled by that. In this particular case, like it was my understanding that Kettering didn't pay anything. Now, could they have paid a portion of it in order to get access to some data that they needed that they didn't have good backups for? We see that happen. We see organizations who don't pay the full ransom, but you generally keep negotiations kind of open with the threat actor in case, you know, you do have some type of backup failure. But I've also just seen organizations that are actually able to fully recover and have absolutely no need to pay the ransom at all.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the recent cyber attack at Kettering Health Network and preventative measures with Sean Waldman, CEO of Secure Cyber. So what sort of measures, I guess, you know, hindsight 2020, if we could go back in time, what should Kettering Health have done to avoid this attack? I guess hire you would be the first answer.
Yeah, well, that would definitely be the first step. So not knowing the actual vector of, you know, how it actually happened, one of the first things, which is generally one of the most economical things, is that to ensure that you're actually, that you're educating your staff, you're actually performing good quality, emphasis on that, cybersecurity awareness, and that you're making your staff aware of the threats that are out there, what is happening, how to detect it, how to respond to it. That is definitely step one. Step two is to make sure that you're not getting beat by the basics. And what I mean by that is a myriad of steps, things like making sure that you're up to date on patches. One of the press releases that came out of the Kettering network was that they were sure that their cybersecurity measures were intact now, and that they had performed some patching. Well, that can lead you to believe that maybe they were behind on some patches, or maybe they didn't have some patches applied that they should. So making sure you're well patched, make sure that you've got good anti-malware. Now, this is different than antivirus, right? So any of your listeners out there running, you know, things like Symantec and McAfee and stuff like that, that run a business, there's very specific enterprise anti-ransom or anti-ransomware software that is specifically designed to combat threats like this. And those are generally, you know, good backups, of course, having good backups. And those are generally some of the things that we talk to organizations about in order to protect themselves proactively.
Do you think, were there signs maybe? I mean, you don't work at Kettering Health, so you don't know, but do you think there were signs that something was compromised before a full attack happened? Is there sometimes they sneak in before they get it at all?
Yeah, so there are steps. It's called the attack chain, and there are steps that threat actors will go through. They don't just wake up one day and launch a full on assault on an organization. Sometimes it happens like that. In this particular case, we did have information from Kettering staff because they were pretty vocal on social media and public channels, which is a whole other discussion, about some things that were leading up to that day. And they were things like weird network outages. They were having disruptions on the network. And that can very much be an indication that a threat actor is moving around in the network and that they're possibly testing cybersecurity controls that are out there to see if they can be detected. So, and the last thing is, there were very much unconfirmed reports that maybe the threat actor was discussing this on the dark web. That does happen as well. So there's a lot of people have heard the word chatter by terrorists chattering about attacks and those types of things. And the same thing happens on the cybersecurity side. So often, potentially, threat actors will talk about an incident, or they'll talk about an organization that they have obtained credentials for and they're trying to sell them. And sometimes you can get, 3-6 months heads up potentially that somebody has compromised your network, and that would give you the opportunity to mount a defense.
Now, I'm going to oversimplify it, but can it be as simple as an employee there clicked on a link they shouldn't have, and that's a way that they can get in the first place? Or, I mean, I know it's much more sophisticated than that, and it should be, but not necessarily.
No, I mean, you didn't oversimplify anything. Mm. I mean, a lot of times that's exactly what it comes down to. If the area of the network was not architected correctly and there were opportunities for malware to spread, which often is what happens, then it literally, Amy, can be that simple. It can just be one user opened an email, clicked on a link, and the rest is history. We see that a lot.
So then that makes me want to talk about not just large companies, but individuals. You know, what people hear about people's bank accounts being hacked, social media accounts get hacked all the time. You're constantly having to change your password. Do you, what advice do you give people when it comes to protecting themselves in this hacking day and age?
Well, one of the main pieces of advice that we give is please stop repeating passwords. Please stop using the same password over and over again. That's one of the leading causes of these types of disruptions is that these passwords are just out there sometimes for 15, 20, 25 years. You know, somebody's using the exact same username and password. The second thing that we recommend is using password managers. And those are things like 1Password, Keeper is the one that I use personally. And the reason password managers come in very handy is because the password manager actually generates the secure password for you. So there's no need to keep that pad of paper next to you or underneath your keyboard or on the post-it note that's got the passwords listed. You could just let the password manager know your passwords. I log in all day long to websites and I have no idea what the password is. I've never seen it. I can click on it and look at it if I want to, but it really is coming down to hygiene. It's coming down to good cyber hygiene.
So what about like the fact that, you know, maybe Google autofills for you or your iPhone or even your Android has all the passwords saved in it? Is that secure or is it not as secure as the Keeper thing you were talking about?
Well, specifically talking about browsers and Android devices, the answer is no. About the only thing that I recommend if you're going to use like native password managers, if you're using like the Apple products like Keychain and those types of things, those are fine if you want to adopt those. Don't ever save a password to a browser. And I know some of your users are going to say, well, some of the browsers have password managers in them. Don't do that. Do not save your passwords to the browser. Use a password manager at all times.
And then just back to Kettering Health for a minute. Do we know if Kettering Health's clients should be concerned about their information being leaked? Is there, because every time one of these things happens, you always hear about the company or even the city of Columbus offers free data protection for 2 years and everything will be fine. What do you think? What's your take on that?
I don't know about the everything be fine thing. So, because both the Columbus incident and the Kettering Health, one of the first things that we end up hearing that we heard in both of those incidents is how employees started talking about almost immediate compromises to their bank accounts and suspicious transactions. Now, whether that was actually true or not, that is something that we definitely have heard now twice at the very, very beginning of an incident like that. So to answer your question, yes, they should be concerned. One of the first things that we recommend that all of your listeners should do is to freeze your credit. It's completely free. You can contact each credit bureau individually and freeze your credit. It doesn't cost anything to unfreeze it. So should you need to, you know, get a car loan or those types of things, it's very easy to do. And here's why they should be concerned is because it could take months. I mean, it could take months in order for the forensic process to go through all of those files that were taken to come to a determination that a threat actor did have access and touch that information. So of those, I think you said 763,000 files, we're not really sure how many of those files contained protected health information. And we're also not sure what was actually touched or taken by the threat actor. That will take a forensic process, which takes a long time.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the balance, especially for a healthcare system, between easy access to information and getting rid of all of that old paperwork? I mean, we all used to have to go to a doctor's office every single time. You had to fill out all these forms. Now you can just have it all online and it is easier, but do they just have to be willing to spend the money and keep it updated to keep that secure, and that's the way to get rid of the paperwork?
Well, much of what's going on in the healthcare world is almost all of the doctors and practices are being forced to do electronic records. Now that opens up a good question. Like you said, you know, what happens to the paper records that are on site after they move to digital? And then, you know, what's the record retention of that information? It's the same thing we deal with on the government side. The only difference is, like, on the government side, there's records retention laws. And almost all of those organizations are bound to some type of regulation from the state that dictates how long those records are kept. Now, often, to your point, what we see is organizations keep that data almost infinitely. Mm. So number one, you know, we definitely need to follow records retention laws and policies and do not hold on to that data any longer than we have to.
Well, I guess my final question would be, your company, Secure Cyber, you offer help to companies. Companies can hire you to help them be more secure. So do you work with for-profit companies, nonprofits, governments? What's the future look like for being able to protect this information? Is it getting, do you have it all figured out, or is it getting harder?
I'd say we have it figured out, but it's getting harder. because, like, well, to answer your question first, yes, we help commercial organizations. We're very heavily in the local government space, manufacturing, financial, to help those organizations run assessments, right? Have your, many of these organizations just get so caught up in their day that they never really think of having somebody from the outside just take a look at their environment and see if there's risk. That's honestly one of the simplest things you can do is just have somebody take a look at things from the outside in, different set of eyes. Do we have a process? Of course we do. Of course we, you know, we feel that our process, as any company you would interview, would be very confident of their processes. Mm-hmm. However, it's getting harder because, you know, we could do a whole show on this. AI. Mm-hmm. AI has, if I can't go 10 feet without somebody asking me about my thoughts about AI and how are things going with AI? Is it out of control? You know, the answer is yes. So while, you know, we think we have a really good handle on how things are today and how to guide organizations to be secure, we really have to keep watching that. The analogy I give is a freight train headed right for us, right? It starts mm-hmm. out as a really dim light that you can see coming down the track, but eventually that light gets really brighter and that train gets a lot closer. And that's AI today, right? So we've really got to keep our eye on the ball and make sure that, you know, we're offering counter solutions to combat AI and its threats that it imposes.
That was Sean Waldman, founder and CEO of Secure Cyber, a company that helps businesses and governments protect themselves against cyber attacks. Thank you for your time today, Sean.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we are going to talk about Ohio State requiring students to take an AI fluency course. That is when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The ways AI touches our lives is increasing by the day, so understanding artificial intelligence and being able to use it responsibly is becoming more important. Ohio State University and many other universities around the country are responding to the proliferation of AI by wanting students to be fluent in combining AI with conventional learning. Ohio State has decided to make a requirement for all undergraduate students to train in AI and learn how it can be responsibly applied. Joining us now to discuss how AI will be incorporated into OSU's curriculum is Ravi Belamkonda, an executive vice president and provost of The Ohio State University. As chief academic officer, he oversees the university's academic enterprise of more than 8,600 faculty who teach nearly 67,000 students. Welcome to All Sides, Ravi.
Thank you so much, Amy. Thank you for your interest.
So starting with this incoming freshman class this fall, all students will be taught AI and how to apply it to their field of study. Why did Ohio State start this new AI fluency initiative right now?
No, essentially what's happening in the world, as you know, is there's an incredible amount of data in every domain of interest to our students, from business to medicine to law to poetry and literature. Increasingly, we live in a very, very data-rich world. And the power of AI is to help us make meaning of that data and see patterns. And so we feel it is our responsibility to equip our students with the best tools available to pursue the interests that they have. And AI, after the paper in the LLMs that Google published in 2017, laying out the transformer architecture and such, as you know, is real, and as your previous guest alluded to. And we feel it's our responsibility to harness this tool in the service of the things that our students and our faculty care about, all the way from the humanities to the arts to the sciences to medicine and to our professional disciplines.
So this initiative prioritizes the incoming freshman class and every class that comes thereafter. What led you to decide to do it for every single student?
This is the thing. So usually when other universities are thinking about this, they're starting programs in AI, a degree in AI, a major, a minor, a certificate. What we're saying is it's a tool. And we'd like our students to be bilingual in the tool. And when you think about fluency and think about it as a language, usually, you know, you learn a language, but you usually are trying to communicate something using a language. And when you're fluent, you're just thinking about your ideas that you're trying to pursue and not the language itself. And so what we'd like to do is for our students to have enough fluency with AI that they don't think of it as AI. They just pursue their interest of trying to cure cancer or invent a new company or a new business model or whatever it is that they'd like to do. And we believe it's important for us to equip them with this really powerful approach that synthesizes data, allows us to see patterns, makes it easy for us to interact with it and flourish in the world by knowing the best tools possible in the service of what they're interested in.
Now, talk to me about logistics here. What's this going to look like? Are all the freshmen going to be sitting in a class about AI? Are they going to be online? What's happening with the way you're teaching it?
No, it's. Thank you for that question. So when Ohio State decides to do something, the scale obviously can be daunting. And so we're approaching this very thoughtfully, one step at a time. We have something called the general education requirements, where all students take a set of classes. And so we're embedding AI and essential, the first language, what is AI? How should we think about AI? What does it mean when we say AI? Just some fundamental basic literacy about AI in a launch course that all our students are required to take. Subsequently, we have workshops, we have teach. So the other thing that's going to happen with this is our students, as you well know, are already using AI in their high schools before they show up. In many ways, the challenge is how do you integrate those tools in the context of their majors and the subjects they're learning, right? We have a robust way to have our faculty also have training to incorporate AI tools into their courses. So what we have planning this fall is that we have a launch course, we have workshops, we have a Gen AI course, and new courses are being designed, AI for Humanities in our Arts and Sciences College and such. So all of that work is going on with the idea that by 2029, when this incoming class graduates, every student is fluent. That's our goal. So for this entering class, when it graduates, every student is fluent, no matter what their major. So that's the power of what we're trying to do. That's what sets apart Ohio State from what, as far as I'm aware, any other university in the world is trying to do.
And I know you have to start somewhere, but what about current sophomores, juniors, and seniors? Do they pick it up on the back end?
Great question. Indeed, these courses are open to all. And So we had to set a goal, and that's the goal we've set, class of 2029. But absolutely, already our students are using it. In fact, we have many faculty, by the way, already incorporating AI in very interesting ways. We have a chemistry course which has AI tutors already working and helping teach chemistry to our students. So we have, this is not a new thing in the sense that in various pockets of the university, different people are already experimenting with it. We are just making this formal and setting the goal that we'd like every student to be sort of fluent by 2029.
Now, what will the students be using when it comes to AI? ChatGPT, Claude, Copilot? There's several.
Yeah, we'd like to be, as much as some of the companies would like us to be exclusive with one of them, we'd like to be agnostic to that. And so we are now putting in place this summer also permissions with different companies to have a free version, which everybody has, but also have a walled version for our students, where when they put in some data, it is protected and doesn't go into the general pool of data. So we are putting in place all those agreements. I'm not at a liberty to announce all of that right now, but please rest assured that every class, when we are interacting with AI, the students will know when their data is public and they're contributing something to the general data, and when it is sort of protected in Ohio State boundaries, so that our researchers and our students can use AI knowing it's protected.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Ohio State's new AI Fluency Initiative with Executive Vice President and Provost Ravi Bellamkonda. Sorry, Ravi. Ravi Bellamkonda. I got
You
it.
can call me Ravi, no
Yeah,
problem.
thank you. So there's been some controversy surrounding AI in education. I mean, everyone agrees it can be helpful. Everyone agrees you need to learn it, but it can also be misused. You know, the idea of having AI write your term paper for you and that kind of thing. So, how will the university address academic misconduct in the future when it comes to AI?
Absolutely. It's a really critical question. It really depends on what the learning objectives are in a course, and every faculty member will set that. So it is true indeed that right now most universities are thinking about AI as a misconduct issue, as you just rightly said. And indeed, that was the case and is the case still at Ohio State, which we are changing now going forward. I think integrity is extraordinarily important, and each professor will determine which assignments and which exams are AI allowed or AI friendly, and which ones may not be. Professors may choose to make exams harder. So I remember when I was in school, I had open book exams and closed book exams, and I preferred the closed book ones because they were easier, but it'll be similar. So I think we will have to follow the rules that the professors set in their courses, but we're just signaling that it is not uniformly bad to use AI in the service of what you're learning. And I'll give you an example. There was indeed a conduct case where one of the professors wrote, I remember reading as a provost, I get to be the last appeals. And one of the professors says, the work turned in by the student was far beyond their capacity. And on the surface, you may say, well, that's cheating. But I remember my handwriting is not so great, and I was saved by beautiful fonts that we have today. And if indeed a student can produce high quality work with the assistance of some technology, why not produce high quality work as long as we know how to harness it and we're still meeting the learning objectives of understanding our field? So when we say bilingual, I'm serious about it. It's not just that you know AI and you don't have to understand your field. You really need to understand your field to be able to use AI well. And that's what we're trying to do by integrating it and not it randomly, be used here and there without fully being aware how to use it.
Will teachers and professors be taught AI fluency as well? Because I can imagine some professors might be very anti this.
Absolutely. And nobody has to do this. So the idea is that over the major, we'd like some opportunities for each student to have, when appropriate, AI incorporated. We are definitely not going to mandate that every course have it, nor are we going to mandate how to have it. But we're providing resources for our faculty to think creatively about what is an exam when you have AI, right? So that's a profound question. So we have a group of faculty who are meeting now to ask that question. And several of our faculty are already experimenting with this in their various courses, including in subjects like English, to all the way to technical fields. So I think absolutely. So educating and providing resources for our faculty and staff is a big part of the fluency effort.
Now, will the wrong, I'm using air quotes, the wrong use of AI be handled on a case-by-case basis by a class professor each class, or is the university get involved in all discipline cases?
No, we currently have an academic integrity process that is quite robust and fair, and we'll continue to use that process. All I'm saying is all cases of using AI in classes will not be an academic integrity question going forward. There will be prescribed and permitted and encouraged even uses of AI within the classroom to further the understanding of that discipline. And those will not be subject to academic integrity. But if a professor explicitly says you cannot or should not, then and the student continues to use it, then that would be a case of academic integrity. So that's the way we're thinking about it.
And other colleges have initiatives surrounding AI as well. But Ohio State's the first to come out and announce it like this, every member of the incoming freshman class. Did you work with other colleges to discuss this program, or are you kind of trying to pilot something here?
No, I think we all talked to each other provosts and other professors, and I was involved with some version of this, not in the education space, but in research in my previous job. No, this is a bold initiative, and our President Carter has an Education for Citizenship plan. That is a bold plan, and it is one of many things we're going to do in our education space to reimagine the undergraduate experience and the graduate experience at Ohio State. And it is just an amazing time to be at Ohio State, where we are thinking from first principles and asking ourselves, how can we best serve our citizens of Ohio and our students in research and in education? So this is part of a larger plan. We're flipping the curriculum. We're introducing experiential learning in the beginning of student journeys in our multiple disciplines, including business school. We are taking advantage of the scale of Ohio State so that if we innovate in how we teach what we teach, that it has real impact in our state, so they're attractive to employers and our students do very well no matter what profession they choose.
Now, do you see this as a temporary program? 4 to 8 years from now, current elementary school students might be learning all of the stuff they need to know about AI in middle school or high school. So do you need to keep it going?
No, I suspect you. Great question, indeed. So I suspect AI will also evolve. Just as you know, just because people learn English in high school, we still teach English in college. People learn math in high school, we still teach math. I suspect it'll be like that. It's a way of thinking about the world. It's a tool, just like we teach writing and communicating and math. It's not a checkbox where you take one class and you're done. It's really learning to harness it. And that's what happens to math, by the way. I'm an engineer by training. I learned math in high school, but then I learned how to use engineering to change medicine in biomedical engineering. And so that's what will happen, I suspect. We will have some level of training coming into college that is fluid and is changing. We'll take advantage of that, build on it, and put it in the context of doing medicine or law or literature better in college.
Have you heard from some professors who are just completely anti this? Are you going to try to? I mean, I don't know if you're going to try to force them to do it, or is everyone on board?
At a university, we have a multiplicity of ideas and thoughts, which is what makes us a university. And I'm sure there are some who are alarmed with AI, as the general public. We are not different. And indeed, that is one of the reasons why I think we've decided to embrace it. And in the thoughtful environment of a classroom with experts of subject matter, we want to deal with the issues that come up with integrating AI. We don't want this done to us. We want to own it and be part of the conversation to lead on how to do this so we can channel it. So the question is, is this one of these things where we should fight AI? And it's already here. It's here in every part of our lives. And we're saying, let's harness it. Let's do it in an environment like the classroom, which is open to experimentation, open to guidance, where multiple people can bring multiple perspectives. And so I think this is the right way to approach the new world, And I really believe that the people who will thrive in the future will be fluent in AI. It will be a necessary requirement no matter what you choose to do, including pursuing literature or history or political science.
Did Ohio State hire, or are you creating like an AI department, or did you hire some sort of AR, I don't know what word to use, czar to be in charge of this?
No, we actually are fortunate. We have two nationally funded AI research centers. We have considerable AI strengths already in our engineering school, in our data analytics programs, and in other programs. So this is not, we just done, didn't suddenly wake up. We have considerable strengths in medicine and elsewhere in AI. We will hire a few people to help with the training of our workforce, whether it's faculty or students. And we have another thing we hope to announce where we will equip all faculty to have access to AI, even for their research, and to build sort of a, initially, we're calling it a hub to provide resources, like you have a consultancy, if you will, for anybody on campus to say, hey, can AI help me do something better or more efficient? And we were hoping to create such a resource for all of our faculty and staff and students as well.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. That was Ravi Bellamkonda, Executive Vice President and Provost of Ohio State University. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about Apple, which plans to use AI to screen the calls and text of its users. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. In a move a long time coming, in its next update, Apple will be adding software to screen users' calls and texts. Also, with the rapidly rising heat, people are turning to electric coolers to keep their food and drink cold in the great outdoors. And also, with Nintendo Switch 2 record-breaking sales, its competitor Xbox has decided to make its own handheld console. Joining us to talk Apple, electric coolers, Xbox, and more is Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So let's start with Apple. In its upcoming update, Apple will be using AI to screen texts and calls of its users. What exactly does that mean? What are we screening for here?
Well, really, they could be screening for just about anything. The next wave of updates that are coming to all Apple products are all going to have the number 26 in mind. iOS 26, iPadOS 26, macOS Tahoe 26, and all of these are going to tie into the way that you receive phone calls in some way through Apple's handoff feature. So if you get a phone call on your phone and it is, you know, completely silent, there is going to be a service that will answer the phone and prompt the person calling you to provide a reason for calling if they see fit, or they can choose to be transferred directly to voicemail. This is something similar to what Google's Android phones do, but the idea here is to present either on your phone or on another screen the information that is being provided by the person providing that reason, which gives you the ability to either answer the call immediately and start having a conversation with that person, to send that person away entirely, or to actually type a reply and have your phone speak that reply to that person without you having to actually answer the call.
Wow. Okay. So that sounds promising. But will that help reduce scam phone calls?
It will help reduce scam phone calls in very specific situations. Anybody who has answered a scam phone call is entirely familiar with that almost human sounding voice on the other end that has prompts and does things like stutter every once in a while to sound, you know, as human as one can in that situation. But then you talk to them for a couple of seconds and it becomes clear that there's a script that's being, you know, fed by a robotic voice. And so you hang up and, you know, annoyed that they almost got you, you kind of move on with your day. It is entirely possible that as the AI on our phones improve to handle things like this, that the companies that make the software that make those calls will also begin to sound more human and use language in order to bypass you. However, if you are like me and just sort of never answer your phone, then you're going to look down at the reason for calling on the screen, and if it's not a person with my Postmates order because I ordered Taco Bell a half an hour ago, then there's a pretty good chance that I'm not going to answer the phone anyway. So it's very much going to depend on who the person is and what kind of scam call they receive on a regular basis as to how effective this is going to be. But it's certainly better than what we've got now.
Now, Samsung and Google have had software like this for years. Apple is the most popular smartphone manufacturer in the world. So why did its competitors have this call screening long before Apple?
This just comes to a difference in philosophy. Google and, by their partnership with Samsung, have long believed that it is perfectly acceptable for the data on your phone to exist within Google's cloud service. So that means that the ability to handle natural language speaking systems can be shared with a computer that lives in the cloud. Whereas Apple's philosophy for quite some time, right, wrong, or indifferent, is to have as much local computing happen as possible so that your data doesn't leave your phone and go somewhere else. The processor on an iPhone or an iPad is now powerful enough that it can handle a vast majority of this, conversational format without that data leaving your phone. And that's why it's being released now instead of a couple of years ago.
Will Apple's call screenings method be different than Samsung or Google? Do you know if it's the same?
It will certainly be different. It's going to use a different set of technologies that are built entirely by Apple. They're not going to let us know, the specific details about how it's going to be different until we've got the ability to test a lot of these things for ourselves when this software is available on the next generation of iPhones in September. But what we do know is that this is a system, Apple's update cadence for things tends to be quite a bit slower than Apple or than Google's and by virtue of that, Samsung's. So if a feature on this doesn't work exactly the way that you feel like it should, it could be up to a year before Apple improves it with the next version of the operating system update in order to, learn from as many different, sources as possible and produce one single viable update instead of lots of tiny updates over time, which is typically Google's approach.
And what has public reaction been to this announcement?
I think the thing that I saw most, especially across social media, was it's about time. This is obviously, I can't count how many times, we've had some variant of a conversation about scam calls just on this show. It's a thing that plagues everyone every day. And so, it is unfortunate that we don't have kind of a higher level way to deal with this. But for now, we'll be able to, instruct the tiny robot that lives in our phone to help us sort out the people that we shouldn't be talking to.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about some recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. So there is a new electric cooler out there. What company is the primary producer of an electric cooler, and why do we want an electric cooler?
Yeah, so there are a couple of these out there right now. Yeah. One of the more popular ones is called, it's another one of these long names. It's the Anker Solix Everfrost 2. As the name would suggest, this is not the first one that they have made. And there are several other companies that have made them. And it's, at its core, this is essentially a cooler with a great big battery in it and a lot of the same tech that goes into very small refrigerators. So this is essentially a refrigerator that will, go on wheels for about 4 hours to be able to keep things pretty cold. Especially if you're operating with food that absolutely must stay cold in a way that can't be kind of watered down by just dumping it in a thing of ice.
Okay, so people have been using coolers to store food outside for decades. So why would one want to switch from using ice, as you said, to getting this electric one? Besides, I'm assuming the electric one is more expensive than my traditional $25 one that I get, you know, from the store.
It's not only considerably more expensive, but it's also a lot heavier because you have to keep in mind all of the electronics that are in there, and then batteries, you know, weigh quite a bit. So if we were to compare this to some of the really high-end coolers that exist out there, I know you just mentioned a $25 one, but there are some...
Yeah, I don't have a Yeti, I know.
That's right. You know, some of these ones by Yeti or Arctic or some of these that are just standard coolers that are, you know, vacuum sealed and do things like that can get up to $300 in some cases. But that is nothing compared to some of these battery powered ones. The Anker one that I mentioned earlier is $900 when it is not on sale. It promises up to 52 hours of cooling runtime on a single battery, and there is the ability to swap out batteries. However, it is at its empty weight, just over 50 pounds.
Woo!
Holds quite a bit. You can hold up to 42 quarts in there. It is you know, weighted as a 40 liter cooler. But yeah, it's heavy. You're really going to make sure that those wheels don't fall off.
Is it? It's 50 pounds empty. So before I put in all my stuff.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there are several tests that we performed where we got this to be as heavy as 70 pounds.
Okay. And how long did you say things will stay cool for versus my ice pack?
So this is 52 hours on a single battery. You can pay for an additional battery that would bring it up to 4.3 days based on our testing if you run it side by side. However, that increases the price to just shy of $1,000. Whereas the Arctic that I mentioned earlier has an average span of about 5 days if you, you know, keep it sealed and you know, keep it, you know, keep the ice in there.
Okay, so 5 days, but you have to open it to get stuff out from time to time. So is it?
Yeah. And it's also just, you know, we're comparing, you know, a ruggedized cooler that is designed, you know, to basically be, you know, buried underground at a campsite for several days while all of your stuff stays cool, to something that you're probably not going to bring up the side of a mountain. This is probably something that will keep cool at, you know, the side of a beach, you know, but it can stay cool even with the sun beating on it. Which is, you know, valuable in some very specific use cases.
All right. And then seemingly to try to rival Nintendo's massive console sales, Xbox has announced it's releasing its own portable console. And can you tell me more about it? So it's called... is it called the ROG, the Rogue? What are we calling it?
Yeah, so
I don't
Microsoft,
know.
Microsoft's Xbox team is actually partnered with tech company Asus, A-S-U-S, okay. To lean into their ROG line. The ROG line stands for Republic of Gamers, because we are all factions now.
Okay, I should have known that. So, I should have known that. I'm sorry, ROG.
That's
all right.
Right. So this is called the ROG Xbox Ally, and the goal here is very similar to the Nintendo Switch, to have a standalone console that is capable of playing Xbox games. This is not all that different from several of the other you know, similar designs that are out there right now that run versions of Windows that allow you to play, you know, kind of native Windows games. This will just be visually considerably more curtailed towards the Xbox experience.
Now, is Xbox just wildly behind in creating a handheld thing, or was that just not their business proposition because they were so popular in the 2000s and the 2010s?
I promise there are still loads and loads of people playing Xbox every day. They are still one of the most popular consoles on the planet. However, you know, the experience that you get from an Xbox is just very different from what you get from a Nintendo Switch. There is a focus on quite realistic graphics and you know, being able to play online with a ton of different people, and that just up until quite recently hasn't lent itself very well to a handheld experience. It's really only been as tech has improved over the last couple of years that this has even really been a viable option. But it will mean that by the time we get to the holiday season this year, that there will be a choice between, you know, the Xbox handheld experience or the Nintendo one.
And the Ally looks remarkably similar to the Nintendo Switch on the outside. What features does it have that will make it different than the Switch?
So, I mean, the big differences that we're going to find there is that the hardware is going to be considerably more capable. We have yet to hear any promises regarding battery life, because this is not a product that has actually been on the market yet. But this is a full gaming computer that is the size of a handheld. You can expect it to be a little thicker than a Nintendo Switch and likely quite a bit heavier. But it'll, you know, time will tell as to exactly how this competes with the product that Nintendo has produced.
And 2024 was reported to be one of the worst years for Xbox sales in the company's history. So how much do you think that influenced their decision to make this jump to mobile?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You know, Microsoft had originally announced a partnership with Nintendo to attempt to find a way to, you know, for some coexistence between the two platforms a couple of years back. And that didn't really materialize in a way that made either company particularly happy. So I think, you know, Microsoft, the, you know, sales always drop right before the release of a new console. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, you know, Microsoft has been, you know, announcing in various stages for quite some time now. So I wouldn't see this as a slump necessarily for Microsoft, but I would see it as a response to a desire to play these games in a deeply portable fashion.
This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.